been a while, like, I don't know, 6 months, maybe a year, since I mentioned Lord of the Rings. And so it's about time we revisited the source of so many of the great gospel illustrations of our time. This week, I want to take you to the very end of the story. Spoiler alert, but if you haven't watched it already by now, you're probably never going to. And so I'm not going to worry too much about that. You see, to understand the Lord of the Rings, you've got to see how the ending fits in, because the story begins with this birthday party in a place called the Shire. Now, the Shire is this place of like rolling hills and green pastures and still waters. You know, it is this idyllic location where basically, simple people go about their lives. They eat and they drink and they tell stories and they smoke and they celebrate and they live these simple lives that they want to live. But the story doesn't stay in the Shire for very long. Very quickly, it's moving out of there. And the story, for those of you who've watched it already, know that it's a story of perilous journeys, of battles that are won and battles that are lost, of sinister enemies, of love and betrayal, of unexpected victories. And the story ends with two very unlikely heroes, two hobbits who are like tiny, unimpressive people who live in the Shire. They are the great heroes of the story. They manage to defeat the most powerful being in their land, banish his forces from Middle-earth, and free the land from the evil that's been taking it over. Well, I say it ends there. But of course, it doesn't actually end there. For any of you who've read the book or watched the films, you will know that that is not the ending of The Lord of the Rings. No, what happens? The screen fades to black, and you all start collecting up your belongings and getting ready to leave. And then all of a sudden, it comes back into focus, and suddenly, now you're in Rivendell again, and Gandalf's laughing, ho 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 ho, and you're like, oh right, maybe, and then it fades to black again, and then it's still not the end. Now you're at a coronation, and someone's being crowned, and you're like, oh great, the crowning of the king, a suitable ending point, and so it fades to black, and you get your stuff, and no, it's still not over. Another scene. Now you are back in the Shire. And you're watching Sam find love and build a family and all that goes on there. And then it fades to black and it's still not over. Because now you're at harbor and you're getting taken out and you're getting Frodo's getting taken away. Now, many people have commented that by the end you are very ready for the end. By the end of the four endings, you're like, I was pretty well done when Frodo and Sam had thrown the ring into the volcano. Like, I'd got the idea. I didn't need these extra endings. Like, all the action has happened. So why can't it just end? Like, why do you have to have all these extra bits? But Tolkien was clear that the end of the story had to be what he calls the scourging of the Shire. It had to be the recreation of this idyllic place with undulating fields and green pastures and still waters. Like, that was the end because that was what they'd fought for. That was what the whole story was about. The whole story was fighting for that world that was threatened by the ever-expanding darkness. And so the story doesn't end when the darkness is defeated, but the story ends when you're back in the Shire with simple people living their simple lives, celebrating their birthdays, having children, eating, drinking, all those kind of things. You see, they weren't fighting simply for victory. They were fighting for the Shire, for the life they enjoyed there. Now, that stuff at the end is certainly not as exciting as what went before it. But it is the whole point of the book. It is what it was all about. It's what made the sacrifices and the fighting and everything that went before it worthwhile. Now, and I wanted to start there because this is the point we've got to in Exodus 25. That's where we're going to be today, Exodus 25. I'm just going to look at a few verses. But and it would be fair to say that Exodus 25 feels in lots of ways very similar to that end point. Because Exodus has been an unbelievable ride so far. You know, you've had an oppressed people, you've had an evil tyrant, you've had a leader kind of raised up who's going to go and challenge him. You've had God going to war with the great empire of Egypt. You've had the plagues. You've had these million people freed from slavery. You've had them trapped by a huge army in a sea. You've had the sea parted. You've had the people going through it. You've had them going to a mountain, hearing God speak, receiving his laws. Exodus has been wild so far. It's been so exciting. And then you get to Exodus 25. You see, Exodus up until this point has been the kind of thing that films are made of. You know, and many films have been made of it. But unlike Lord of the Rings, the films that are made about it tend to stop before they get to Exodus 25. They tend to stop before the end. They don't bother with the scourging of the Shire and the recreation of everything. They don't bother with that. The drama's done, we'll leave it there. But Exodus itself doesn't end there. It doesn't end after all the story. In fact, it ends with one thing that dominates chapters 25 to 40 of Exodus, and that is the building of the tabernacle. It is not as exciting, it would be fair to say. It's not as dramatic. It makes some pretty heavy and at times pretty tedious reading, in my opinion. There are no battles. There are no miraculous escapes. There are no unlikely heroes. But it's actually the high point of the book. It's actually the point of it all. It's what it was all about. It's the moment where the Shire is recreated. It's why everything that went before it ever bothered being done. It represents the primary goal of everything that has happened so far in Exodus. And to understand this, to understand why this is the high point of the book, these very challenging 15 chapters about the tabernacle, you've got to do the same as you do with Lord of the Rings. You've got to go back to the beginning. You've got to understand the beginning to understand why this represents the end point of this narrative. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and he created human beings as the pinnacle of that creation, the high, they were to share in that creation with him. They were to rule over it under him, but with him as under stewards. And they were to know God. You read at the beginning of the Bible this amazing sentence where you get this glimpse that human beings and God walked together in a garden. So imagine that. Oh, I'm going out for a walk today. Oh, who are you going out for a walk with? God. Like God and you just walking together, talking about all that he created, talking about all God's plans for his creation, talking about your plans for the creation. It would have been truly phenomenal. God and humans walking together, talking to each other, enjoying the creation made. That was where it started, but it doesn't last very long. It lasts a few pages. And by Genesis 3, it starts to go wrong. Because there's an enemy, and that enemy is determined to destroy that garden. And he came and he whispered in the ears of those people, and those people made a fatal error. They listened to him. They listened to what he said, and they started questioning and doubting God, and they did the one thing that God had told them not to do. And as a result of that, they were banished from the garden. No longer would people and God walk together in this garden, enjoying the creation he'd made. But now that creation was broken, they had broken it, and also God and human beings were separated. And the question the Bible then sets about dealing with, really from page like 2 of the Bible, is how can Eden be restored? How can the Shire be the Shire again? How can all that is broken made light. How can we return to a world where God and people walk in a garden together and talk and enjoy his great creation? How can sinful people and a perfect God dwell together without sinful people being destroyed or God's purity being tainted? That's the question that the Bible wants to answer. If you're coming to the Bible with a different question to that, it's not going to answer it particularly well, because that's the question that the Bible cares about. How can this ever be restored? How can God and people get back to a place where they walk together in the good creation that he's made and they enjoy it together as he's intended? Is there any way back? Now that unexpectedly brings us to Exodus 25. Let's have it open in front of us now. Let me read. I'm just going to read nine verses from the start. Exodus 25, verse 1 to 9. I could do six chapters, but then I would have no time to say anything else. So you can read those six chapters at your leisure. I'm going to do nine verses, and then we'll go from there. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell the Israelites to bring me an offering. You are to receive the offering for me from everyone whose heart prompts them to give. These are the offerings you are to receive from them: gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and fine linen, goat hair, ram's skins dyed red, and another type of durable leather, acacia wood, olive oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, and onyx stones and other gems to be mounted on the ephod and breastpiece. Then let them make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you." Now, I really want to focus on those last couple of verses. You might have missed it, but they're actually unbelievable sentences. Because God says there, he says, "Make a sanctuary for me and I will dwell among them." I'll dwell among them. Now, that's the thing that's been impossible ever since Genesis 3. It's just been impossible. It's not been a thing that could happen. God is going to once again dwell with his people. He's going to be with them. And this has been made possible by a collection of things we've seen in previous weeks. It's made possible by the agreement, the covenant that the people make, that they're going to obey God and that they're going to do what he says. You know, God can dwell with them if they obey him and do what he says. They'll be able to enjoy his perfection. He won't be tainted by sin. If they could obey God, they could dwell together. It's made possible by sacrifice, because sin equals death in the Bible, and sacrifices are going to be used to symbolically remove that guilt so they can be with God. It's made possible here by the tabernacle. God is not going to walk with them as he did in the garden, but he's going to dwell with them in a tent. He's going to be amongst them. That was the entire point of the rescue. So as I said, the whole of Exodus has been leading us to this point. God rescued them so that he could be with them. He gave them his laws so that once again, God and people could dwell together. And the reason why this is so important is because this is the greatest loss that humanity has ever suffered. Humanity has suffered some great losses in our time. Huge, huge losses, huge pains. But the greatest is this. The greatest loss, the greatest sadness, the biggest problem came about when we became separated from God. Because at that point, something irreplaceable is removed from our lives. Without God, we lacked the wisdom and instruction of how to live in this world. We increasingly went our own way. And so what happened? Evil abounded. We found new and unusual ways to mess up the world. And so suffering and pain grew and grew and grew. Why? Because we became separate from God, and no longer did we have his wisdom and his instruction guiding us on how to do this right. More than that, without God, we lost the single most fulfilling relationship we could ever experience. Human beings were created to relate to one another. So God created other human beings because he said it's not good for us to be alone. We were created to relate to one another, to know and enjoy each other's company. But before that, we were created to know and enjoy God's company. We were meant to walk with him in the garden, to enjoy being with him. We were created to know human love, but much more importantly, we were created to know God's love. We were created to work and plan with other humans, but much more importantly, we were created to work and plan with God. Now, this is so important because there are many causes of loneliness in our culture. Many. And our culture, there are many reasons why within our culture, loneliness seems to be increasing. Every year, the stats get higher and higher. There are many reasons for that. Lots of things are feeding into that. Social things that are going on, technological things that are going on. There's lots of things that are feeding that. But at the heart of all loneliness is a longing for God. That there is a need for God, a relationship with God, that no amount of human relationships will ever cure, will ever heal. There will never be enough. It's not the only reason why we're lonely, but it's part of it. We are lonely because we were created to walk with God, to talk with God, to know His love, to rule over this world with Him. And without that, we will always feel, to some extent, bereft and adrift. There's more things we could say that were lost that moment that we became separated from God. Without God, we feel insecure and meaningless. Because without knowledge of our Creator, we suddenly feel at the mercy of His creation. When we're not involved with what He's doing, we struggle to find meaning in a world of billions of people pulling in no clear direction. There's so many things that were lost that moment that we became separated from the God we were created to know. And whether we know it or not, whether you're someone here who sits here and goes, yes, I know that, whether you know it or not, all of us long to walk in the garden with our Creator. And yet, it's impossible. It's impossible. We can't do it. We were thrown out. We were separated. We were banished. But here, in Exodus 25, it suddenly seems possible again. God is going to dwell with His people. That lost relationship is going to be refound. It's going to be recreated. God is going to dwell with us again. It's such an exciting moment in the life of human history. It's what all of the plagues were about. It's what all of the rescue was about. It's what all the laws have been about. Everything has been about getting us to this point where we can have that relationship that we were created to have, that we've lost, and that we all suffer the pain of having lost. So what does this section? I'm going to do some stuff from Exodus 25, but you can go from there. What does this have to tell us about how we regain that, about what it looks like for God to dwell with us? But what follows this are six fairly long chapters explaining different elements of how they have to build this tabernacle, this dwelling place for God. What is to go inside? What's the furniture to be like? What are the people to wear? How do they need to prepare themselves for going inside? How often can they go inside? All these kind of things. Now, you can read those chapters at your leisure. The question is, what's the point of it? Why six chapters of this? So we're saying there's six chapters of this, and then at the end of Exodus, there's another six chapters that are basically almost identically the same. So you could ask the question, why 12 chapters of this? Like, why page after page of God saying, this is the way the tabernacle has to function. This is how you get to be in my presence. Well, I think we get a clue in the passage we read. Look at the final verse. Make this tabernacle and all its furnishing exactly like the pattern I will show you. What is the point that God is emphasizing here? It's that if this relationship is going to be repaired, it has to be done on His terms. We have to do it in the way that He tells us to. He gets to determine how people are to approach Him, because how people are to approach Him, because God is the one who is unapproachable, not us. God is the one who is perfect light and cannot tolerate any darkness. God is the one who's incapable of accepting or tolerating sin. And so He is the one who has to tell us how we can go and be with Him, how we can approach Him. Now, human beings don't like this because we've always had a tendency to overestimate our own importance. We've always been inclined to think that we should be the ones calling the shots, that things should be done on our terms. I will approach God how I want to approach Him, how I feel is best. Never has this been more true than in our culture. And of course, that's seeped into how we think about God. Many of us want to approach God on our own terms. So you will hear atheists who say, well, if I ever find myself in front of God, I'll just tell him that there wasn't enough evidence. It's like, I'm just going to approach God on my own terms based on what I think. You have many people who imagine that if they ever face God, they will be able to point to their good deeds as a reason why God should accept them. They'll stand before God and they'll say, you should accept me standing before you because look at the life I've lived. There are many people of many religions who think that ultimately God will accept them because they have believed the right things, done the right things, given money to the right places, prayed at the appropriate frequency, performed the right religious activities. Even among the church, there are many of us who think we can approach God however we want. We can pray how we want. We can worship how we want. We can live how we want. We can teach and believe what we want. And God will just accept it. But God is clear here, and he's clear throughout the Bible. We don't get to determine it. Because we're not the offended party. We're not the one who's unapproachable. God is. God gets to determine what needs to happen for us to be able to approach him. God will tell us what appropriate prayer and worship looks like. God will tell us what our lives should look like and how we should live. Now, it's worth saying, in the Bible, there's a lot of freedom around those areas. You know, God doesn't lay down, you must pray in this particular way, at this particular, there's a lot of freedom. But we've got to stay within the parameters that God's given us because he gets to decide. Just as he says here, they're to make the tabernacle exactly like the pattern he will show them. If you want to approach God, you need to do it his terms. God doesn't give us a pattern for building a tabernacle. He doesn't say, build this building and then you'll be able to come and approach me. That's not what he says to us. But he does tell us how we are to approach him now. He still tells us. And he tells us that the way we are to approach God now is through repentance and faith. That's God's determined means of how we are to be able to approach God. If you want to approach God, you need to confess your sin and ask for forgiveness. You need to turn away from that sin and you need to have faith in what Jesus has done for you on the cross. There is no other way. They are, those instructions are the equivalent of these tabernacle instructions, exactly in the pattern that God has given us. There is no other way we get to approach God. They are the exact instructions which we are given, which enable God to come and dwell with us. That's why as a church we talk about the gospel. You see, the reason that we talk about the gospel is because the gospel is good news. And because it's news, it's something which has happened, which we don't get to shape. You know, we don't get to determine what the news is. The news has happened, we just get to hear it. If you want to know the God who you long for, you need to do it on his terms. That's what he says very clearly to the Israelites here. He continues to say that to us today. If you want to know him, he gets to determine how. That's the first thing that's emphasized in these very long chapters, laying out bit by bit how they're to do it, is that God gets to determine. Here's the second thing. Why, and to answer the second reason, we think, why are these specific instructions given? So why is it that the tabernacle is to be built in this specific way? Why are there requirements for who can enter and when they can enter and where they can enter and what they're meant to do? And why do they get more and more complicated? Surely all of these instructions are to highlight one thing, and that is that even though God will dwell with them, it's still not going to be like it was. God's going to dwell with them in a tent, but when you read these six instructions, it is a long way away from walking in a garden with him. It's not even close. The barrier still remains. And so any encounters between God and the people are still going to be partial at best. They're going to be infrequent. They're going to require a whole host of work. And they are still ultimately going to be at a distance. If the hope was a return to Eden, then what is promised in these chapters is at best a partial return. Sure, God now dwells with them. But his separateness is still emphasized again and again. His unapproachability is highlighted every step of these instructions. The problem of sin to a perfect God is drawn to our attention again and again. Let me try and wrap this up. This is what I think we're meant to do when we get to Exodus 25. we're meant to get here at the climax of the book, the moment where God is going to dwell with his people. We're meant to get here and we're meant to find it slightly anticlimactic. I think that's what we're meant to do with it. This is an anticlimactic climax. Finally, God and people will dwell together again, but it's so much less than we hoped for. We're still so much more separate than we wanted, so much more separate than we need to be. This might be the best that the Israelites could hope for, but surely when you read this, we're left hoping that a better way will be found, that some other way will be created for God to dwell with his people, a way which doesn't require all this separation, all this preparation, all this ongoing distance. If only there was a way for sin to be dealt with, for our guilt to be taken away, for us to be declared perfect, for us to be made perfect. If only that could happen, then this barrier could be removed entirely. Then we could truly be with God, just as they were in the garden. You meant to get here and think, if only that could be dealt with, then we could walk again with him. Not this tent with all these different things we've got to do and some people going some of the time. If only that sin could be dealt with, then we could be with him. And so after centuries of this, God himself comes. And in the person of Jesus, he says, I am going to deal with sin once and for all. I'm going to break down this barrier. And I'm going to not only dwell with my people, but I'm going to dwell in them. How close is that? I mean, that's even closer, right, than walking in the garden. Like, there he's next to you. He's in us. I'm going to live in them. So, God becomes a man. But unlike us, he never sins. He lives a perfect life and then he dies in our place. He takes all the consequences of sin and then he declares that any who will accept the forgiveness he offers, the new life he brings, can come to know the God who made them and who they were made to know. So if you want to go home and you want to read chapter after chapter about the tabernacle, Exodus 25, Exodus 26. Exodus 27, Exodus 28, Exodus 29, Exodus 30, Exodus 31. You get a bit of a break, then you're back. If you want to go home and do that, this is what I want to suggest you do. That as you read it, as you get bogged down in the detail, in all the different materials and the different ceremonies and the different sections, as you get bogged down in all of that, I want you to get frustrated and cry out, surely there must be a better way than this. Only to encounter Jesus and find that there is, and that all of this is done away with. And now through Jesus, we can finally gaze into the face of the God who made us, just as surely they must have done in the garden. Let me pray for us and then we'll see.